So thank you for the introduction and thank you for organizing this, Tim. I think it's been an interesting session so far. First, I have to apparently just read this to you that I have basically no relationships to disclose. Okay, and I want to bring you back 10 years ago. So in the year 2004, George W. Bush was in the White House. Apparently, the number one song for that year was by Usher, according to the Billboard Top 100, but I don't know what song it was. Top grossing movie of the year was Shrek, and gas cost only $1.74 per gallon. So I can officially feel old by telling you that. And in that year, I was down in Atlanta. I was in the Department of Epidemiology at Emory University, completing my dissertation. At this point, I had completed 3 of the 4 studies of my dissertation and was just starting the original data collection phase. And so while I was preparing this presentation, I really think of my lessons as applying to somebody who, those of you in the audience who might still be in graduate school finishing up, or if you're a recent graduate, or if you're somebody who has graduate students right now, maybe lessons you need to remind them of. So this was my favorite diagram to include when I was on the job talk circuit. So the main reason for my dissertation was to look at whether obesity was affecting the biological effectiveness of oral contraceptives. But there were other pathways involved that I had to consider. So the blue, that's all the different pathways that I looked at. And the little quotation boxes are all of my different studies that I did to look at these different pathways. And so the ones that I'll be talking about today are the ones in the orange quotation boxes. So that was the Contraceptive History Initiation and Choice Study, where the main purpose of that was to look to see if obesity was associated with either adherence to an oral contraceptive regimen or frequency of sexual intercourse. So the reason this was important to my dissertation was there weren't many studies done on this topic when I started. Only one study had been published out of UWASH that looked at obesity and oral contraceptive failure, and they were kind of dinged by reviewers, and then I was eventually dinged by reviewers that I didn't have these confounders as things to potentially control for in my analyses. So this is why I decided to do this. And so it was a prospective cohort study of women 18 to 45 years of age who attended an Emory Family Medicine clinic. And so I recruited women directly from the waiting room. There was an initial survey that anybody, as long as they were female and between 18 and 45, they could fill out that initial survey. And then based on those responses, women who were oral contraceptive users were then invited to participate in completing diaries. So there were 5 one-week diaries that collected information on adherence and frequency of sexual intercourse. And then there was also a medical record abstraction phase, which I'll come back to in a couple of slides. So my first lesson is choose a good study acronym. So when I went into this, I assumed, so contraceptive history, initiation, and choice, I was going with the idea of chic, okay? But apparently you should not assume that people will pronounce it the French way. So everybody, including all the members of my dissertation committee, called it the chic study. So apparently I should have tacked on the word knowledge at the end there, so it would have been contraceptive history, initiation, choice, and knowledge study, and then it really would have been the chick study, but lesson learned. Okay, so again, so the purpose was to look to see if obesity was related to either adherence or frequency of sexual intercourse. So the idea was I would then be able to use this information to do a sensitivity analysis of my other studies to then, you know, determine if this was really having any impact on my main associations. Now, the initial questionnaire, I wanted to keep it to something short, something one page front and back, because people were completing that out of the goodness of their hearts. I had gotten a very tiny grant to try to do this, so it was not a lot of money. And it basically covered, you know, photocopying, buying paper, that sort of stuff. And the problem that I was running into was that people wanted to add more and more to this initial survey. So five dissertation committee members, each wanting to add 5 to 10 questions, was translating into something that was going from one page to 5 pages. And I was very concerned that people were not going to fill this out for free if I handed them a 5 or 6 page survey. I had a little bit of money for the diaries. Back 10 years ago, there were these things called video stores where, you know, people actually went to the store to pick out a video. I mean, it was a hot date, you know. You went and picked out a movie together. But so I had coupons for the diary portion where when women completed a diary and mailed it back, I would mail them a coupon for a free movie rental. But that was just for the diary portion. Didn't have that for this initial survey. So I started to feel very overwhelmed as this was getting to be a larger and larger survey, and concerned that nobody was going to fill it out and I was never going to finish my dissertation. So I called actually the woman who had been my advisor when I was completing my master's and spoke to her about it to get some advice. And when I was done talking with her, what I did was I created a table. I listed every single variable that people wanted me to collect and two more columns about did it help with the first aim, did obesity, was that related to adherence, or did it help with the second aim, that it was related to frequency of sexual intercourse. And for many of these variables, neither one of those columns had a check mark. And I brought that to the chair of my dissertation committee and kind of laid it out there saying, you know, these, while interesting, it's not helping me in terms of answering my primary aims. And luckily, she agreed with me. I was able to cut back, get back to my one-page survey. So, you know, I think sometimes you have to remember your dissertation is not your time to answer every single question that's ever been posed. So you need to kind of, you know, focus in, which was a comment made by an earlier group as well. So in terms of the medical record abstraction, in terms of why I added that. So on the initial survey, women self-reported their height and weight, and then I abstracted it from the medical records. Because a common criticism of the studies that had been done on obesity and oral contraceptive failure were that you were relying on self-reported height and weight. And all of these studies were retrospective in nature. So you always knew when it came time to write your articles that in your limitation sections, you know, you needed to fess up to that, but also try to provide some sort of support about why it wasn't that big of a deal. Unfortunately, the studies that you were using to try to justify the use of self-reported height and weight were studies that had been done in men, older women, outside of the United States, or really old data from the 1980s. So while you were addressing this in your limitation section, it seemed that perhaps you weren't addressing it with data that was really applying to a population of reproductive age women. So that was why I included the medical record abstraction phase. And this is another comment that came up about medical record abstraction. So I had an initial plan created with the physician at the clinic. So she was very supportive of me being there and collecting my data. And the idea was that I would wait till I was almost done with my original data collection, and they would pull 50 records for me at a time for me to abstract the information. And it worked great at first, but there was a lot of turnover at this particular clinic. And the new person in medical records complained to the practice manager that I was creating too much work for her. And so they told me I could have 10 records per week. So keeping in mind that I, you know, was already applying for jobs and everything, planning my final dissertation defense, 10 records a week was not going to cut it in terms of me ever being able to finish. So, you know, spoke to them again, and then I was told, well, you can pull them and you can refile them. And so immediately, millions of red flags were popping up in my head that this was filled with no-nos, that I should not be doing that. And so I wound up going and talking to both my dissertation chair as well as the physicians in the clinic about this. And they agreed that under no term should I be the person taking these files out and refiling them. And so, they eventually talked to the other staff and said, no, you know, we have to pull these for her. You know, we're invested in this project. We need to do this. And because of the high staff turnover, yet another person came, and it wound up being okay and getting it done. But, you know, it has really shaped how I do research now in clinical settings. I was viewed as a nuisance. The physicians had buy-in for why I was there, but that's kind of where it ended. To the point where, you know, I was told to sit by the front staff people so I could then see when people came into the waiting room, which was totally fine. And I would go out and I'd recruit them, but they wouldn't give me the code to get back to where the front staff were. So I would have to knock on the glass for them to let me in. And on some days, it was good for recruitment, and this would happen 17 times until the women who were working at the front desk were tired of getting up and letting me in, and they eventually gave me the code. But it was to that point where they wouldn't even give me the code to get back to where my stuff was. So I've really made sure that I, you know, now at UNC Charlotte, I found people to collaborate with who are used to doing research. Just having the physician buy-in isn't enough. You need everybody to be on board with you and to understand how research works. And so I've spent a lot of time when I first came to Charlotte making sure I found clinics who were truly used to doing research, because I didn't want my own students to have to go through that again. You know, just give me the 4-digit code to get back, please. So this is what made it into my final conclusions chapter of my dissertation that was related to the medical record abstraction. So the CHIC study, and even I'm calling it CHIC now, allowed an opportunity to explore the validity of self-reported height and weight among a group of women of reproductive age. Height and weight provided on the initial study questionnaire were compared to height and weight abstracted from the medical record for 275 women. On average, women underestimated their weight by 4.6 pounds and overestimated their height by 0.10 inches. So using self-reported height and weight, 84% of women were correctly classified into their true BMI category. So next lesson is to really keep some future article ideas in your back pocket. So I had defended my final dissertation in March, graduated in May, got married in August, started a new job in August, so it was a big year for me. And this was the first article that I then started to work on, because I always felt that even though it was like 3 sentences of my dissertation, that there was something important here that deserved its own paper. And so this was a little outside of my comfort area, because I really didn't do straight methods types of papers up until that point. And it was also my first and actually only solo work. So other people spoke about this as well. I think as a field in public health, we're very big on collaboration. However, at the same time, when you first graduate, you're told you need to become an independent researcher. You need to cut the ties of the people that you used to work with. And so this kind of represented my transition from my collaborators at Emory, did this myself, found my collaborators that I would work with at UNC Charlotte. So there might be another lesson there, but I'm not entirely sure. So then this is from the article itself, published in Maternal Child Health Journal. So again, underestimated weight by 4.6 pounds, overestimated height by 0.1 inches, which then translated into BMI being underestimated by 0.8 kilograms per meter squared. And all women, regardless of age, education, race, ethnicity, or marital status, underestimated their weight. And so again, all put together, self-reported height and weight measures classified 84% of women into the appropriate BMI categories. So bottom line, even though we lie about our weight, we're all lying, and not lying so much that we wind up in crazy categories as a result. And this is a table from the actual article. And again, you're interested in the bolded portion that's showing the women who both self-reported and measured BMI are putting them in the same category. And what's also important is even for the people who are misclassified, it's at least an adjacent category. So there's nobody who measured BMI says they're obese, but they're getting put into underweight, for example. So they're at least getting put into adjacent categories. So also a common lesson from other ones is persevere. So Maternal Child Health Journal was actually the third journal that I sent my manuscript to. The others were more clinical in nature. I won't mention them by name. First one didn't send it out at all. Second one sent it out, but it was one of those reviews that you got back that was like a one-sentence review and you know the person didn't really read it, because their comment was, I should spend my time trying to publish the main findings of my study, which if the person had read it, they would have seen it was cited in the methods section and talked about. So I didn't really read it. And then I decided to send it to Maternal Child Health Journal. So luckily, I was young and not disillusioned yet, okay, about the process. I think we've all had that paper that we know is good and deserves to be published, but you just have to find the right home for it. And so sometimes that means just trying again. So, you know, don't give up. And as far as I'm concerned, I think it's the other journal's loss. So thank you. So how to get your work out that's already been published? Okay. So that's okay. So that's a different one, not what I was expecting. Okay. No, thank you. Yeah, I mean, it sounds silly, but yeah, like if there's another paper and you cite yourself, I guess, you know, like you can.
Blog about it.
Yeah. I mean, or depending on what your job is, if there's something that, you know, if there is something on a website, like sometimes they'll have little, you know, corners on website where people write about, you know, recent research or something like that. If there's a way to kind of bring up something that you've been published on a website setting like that, maybe, or, you know, even like alumni things from, you know, if you, a master's thing, PhD thing, or whatever, to, you know, a lot of times alumni magazines will ask you to, you know, submit things, maybe something along those lines would work in terms of being able to put your information out there again.
Question for you and all the presenters is, did one publication beget more? Does, you know, getting the first one in make it easier to get more in?
I mean, I think so. This was my, when I published this one, I had published all the other studies off of my dissertation at that point. So this was my fifth article. And I do think it gets easier. You develop a tougher skin, too, I think. I mean, those first ones, when you would get a rejection back, you know, you'd be so mad. Like, I want to write him back and say, you didn't read this, you know. And you get so mad about that. And now you're just like, yeah, okay, another person who didn't really read it. And, you know, I think you develop a tougher skin about things, and it does become easier in terms of publishing. Sometimes, although some of them are blinded, so it shouldn't really matter.
Thank you.